Okay, today is July 15th, 1997, and we're interviewing Paul Fortino, and I am Thomas Flail. And we're going to start by having Paul tell us how his parents got to the United States.
Okay. My father was born in Calabria, Italy in 1878. And my mother was born in
1898,
he completed military service, and the same year he married my mother. And my mother was born in 1880.
Paul, tell him.
He heard a great deal about border service in Argentina, so he, that's the first thing he did. He went there, and he figured that the economy would be better there than it was in Italy. And while he was there, he went in the milk business for a short time. Well, he had that for quite a while, but then he heard about Brazil. Well, Brazil is very rich in minerals and so forth. That might be a good country. So he went to Brazil. I was very disappointed there in Brazil. So he decided to come to this country. Came here, and first place he hit him was Zeeland, Michigan. He was headed for Holland. How he ended up in Zeeland, I don't know. And he doesn't know. But he got a job the first day in a brick factory in Zeeland. I used to know the name of that brick factory, but I forgot the name of it now. Very well known. Meantime, his friends in Holland said, "What are you doing in Zeeland? You belong in Holland." So we went to Holland and stayed with Charlie Fabiano in Holland. And while I was in Holland, he went to work in Donnelly Kelly Glass Factory, which is now known as the Donnelly Company. While there, he became an expert on plate glass. He worked there for several years, trying to go in business for himself.
Now remember, at this time, too, Tom, my grandmother was not with him.
No.
Okay.
You had to leave.
He
your,
left.
He had to leave his
himself.
Mother, or his wife, and his new son, who was my dad's brother, Frank, in Italy.
Okay. No. He's trying to establish himself.
He had to come back.
Right. So he took the streetcar to northern Michigan, and all the way down, stop at various cities. So he wanted to go in business for himself. Finally, he hit Muskegon. While in Muskegon, he decided to buy some tobacco. So he went to a little tobacco store and bought tobacco and on Western Avenue. And he said to the house, "How's he going?" "Well," he said, "it's pretty good, but my wife doesn't like it. It's too rough here. It was rough in those days. So I'd like to sell out." He says, "Well, how much do you want?" "I want $25. He says, "Well, all right, here's $25. And the man had the key. He was in business for himself in Muskegon.
$25.
That's all it took, you know what I'm saying?
And a handshake.
Yeah.
So he locked the door, went to Grand Rapids, bought a showcase, and he went to Gyrot, bought some cigars, cigarettes, and so forth. And he went to another fellow that had...
Steiner
paper had... paper goods, but his fruit came from another fellow in Muskegon. I can't think of his name now, but he was in business for years in Muskegon. So he was in business. While there...
He had what, like a tobacco at a fruit stand then? He sold fruits,
oh,
and
yeah.
Vegetables, and tobacco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, after a short time there, my mother came.
It took her almost 7 years to get enough money to bring her back.
She came.
To bring her over, I mean.
Then Muskegon, they heard about Grand Haven. They heard the man of Grand Haven wanted to move to another city. They came to Grand Haven and bought out Charlie Spadafore. much his name is here.
Okay. So, but on his side, when he got to Grand Haven, he thought it was God's country.
Yeah.
He got off the interurban train and thought it was the most beautiful, didn't he, Dad?
Yeah.
And that was it.
He always said this is God's country.
That was his words.
And the reason for it, because it was awful good to him. Mm. He started right off. It wasn't a retail business. And later on, in 1920, it was a wholesale business. Everything came in Grand Haven, carload lots. That's mentioned in this book, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
Carload lots of bananas and oranges and watermelons, all by carload. So he's a wholesaler as well as a retailer. In 1920, after the war was over, my brother Frank was in World War I. He came back from war, took over the wholesale business. My dad stayed in the retail business. Yeah. Am I recording now?
Yep.
Okay. I was born in 1913, okay.
And your brother Frank was born in 1899.
That's right.
So it was a long separation of time there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you were born, you said, in Muskegon, but you lived in Grand Haven your whole life.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
my dad was the first child born in America to their family.
Yeah.
Frank was born in Italy.
Well, I graduated high school in 1931. During the Depression, I couldn't go to college because of the Depression, so I went. 1932, I went to Notre Dame. I took chemical engineering. I go 1 year and stay out for a year, work. But finally, in 1938, I graduated with honors. Notre Dame as a chemical engineer. I got a job at Seagram's Distillery in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, but tell me what you went through before you, how hard it was to find a job.
Well, I think we're getting.
My brother Fonzie was born in 1914 and died from rheumatic fever in 1919. My brother Mike was born in 1916. My sister Mary was born in 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And my second Fonzie was born in 1920.
It's an Italian tradition to name a second child the same name as the first if you've lost
him. No. The second foster was 17 years old playing football at Grand Haven, and
he got spiked in the head with a shoe. In those days, they had cleated shoes, but very poor
helmets.
No helmets. Yeah. They had leather hats.
Oh, it hit the head, and he died from it. So,
that was why you were at Notre Dame.
Now, where are we now?
Okay, that's your brothers and sisters.
Yeah. I went to Louisville, Kentucky, and worked for Seagram's Distillery as a chemical engineer. After a short time there, I was transferred to Lawrenceburg, Indiana. And while I was working there, I met a girl and I fancied.
Not with me.
I think she's sitting at the table.
Yeah.
She was secretary to the chief engineer. So I have to go with the chief engineer quite often. I went there to talk to the chief engineer, but I had my eye on her all the time. So I had other dates, of course, but they didn't count. But she was going with somebody else in the meantime. But I didn't want to intrude. When I was told that she broke up with her boyfriend, I moved in right away. I didn't waste any time. We got married. Well,
that was 56 years ago.
We married in 1941.
1941, we got married.
Just before the war started, actually.
1941, I think we had a policy of transferring an engineer every 2 years. They transfer him to California, to Philadelphia, to Canada. And I figured that was no life for me, to be transferred every 2 years. So I took over my dad's business in 1941. I took it over. My dad retired.
Okay, now you had talked about your dad had the two businesses going, and your brother took one of them. Was your father's business then that you're taking over?
He quit. He retired.
Yeah, but going back to 1920, when you had the wholesale, and Frank took that.
Frank took over.
your dad stayed with the retail.
Oh, yes, of course.
Right. And his retail was, explain that, what that business was for us.
He put some vegetables, mostly.
Okay.
But it is, he put in groceries. Yeah. 1941, he retired and I took over. And I took the business and changed it completely from fruits and vegetables to a gourmet shop.
And you didn't have liquors and wines until after...
No, we had it by that time. We had it.
Yeah, but not until after Prohibition, correct?
Not
before Prohibition either, right?
After Prohibition, I guess so. After Prohibition.
but not before Prohibition started, you didn't have that, right? You were just fruits and vegetables before Prohibition?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You didn't get a license until after Prohibition.
After Prohibition was over, yes.
And we were the first licensee?
In Grand Haven.
In Grand Haven.
Yeah. After those workshops got it right away the following year.
Yeah.
I took over and changed the whole complexion. I have a feeling that the day was done as far as fruits and vegetables are concerned. By changing it into a gourmet shop and liquors and beer and wine and so forth.
And fancy candies.
And hand-dipped chocolates.
But that was due to the fact that the changing idea of...
This young man did a lot of research on immigration in Michigan.
Yes.
Okay, you're on. You want me to turn off or on?
The first immigrant into Grand Haven was a fellow by the name of Belfino. He was the first immigrant to Grand Haven, 1896.
First Italian immigrant, yes.
He went in business, and he was very successful. And in 1907, he decided to go back to Italy and become a banker.
He done very well here.
He sure did. And so he sold to Charlie Spadafore.
But he yearned to go back. Balsito wanted to go home, right?
Yep. He went home, became a banker. So he sold to Charlie Spadafore. Charlie Spadafore had it for 5 years. I didn't give up and went to Lansing. And he sold to my father.
In those 5 years before that, my grandfather was in business in Muskegon.
Right.
That's
well, my father took over in 1911 in Grand Haven. He started Muskegon in 1907, Grand Haven in 1911. He started. And he went to 1941 when he retired, and I took over.
Yep.
So up to that time, there was very few Italians in this area.
Oh, yes.
And they didn't compete with each other, did they, Dad?
No.
You should say that.
No.
No, they never went in business in the same city that another branch of the family was in.
That's so right. They would move to all these little towns.
Unless the town was big. The town was like Muskegon. They had two of them there.
You could support two different businesses.
Yeah, Holland had two. Mm-hmm. Because Holland, to this day, is sort of predominantly Dutch, and much more so than in those days. As she indicates here.
So the Italians would spread out.
Yeah.
That's why there was not a large cluster of them.
Yeah.
One would establish it. What was it, your father's cousins that he wrote back to Italy too? And word of mouth. That's why more people came back here. Right, Dad?
Yeah. Yes.
But they
after
also,
my father started, another fellow took over. Company of Tony Caruso took over, came here, and started an ice cream parlor.
See, that was all right. That was not a competing business.
Yeah.
And where he was located, where Kirk's Camera Shop used to be.
Right. Which is on...
Where Euroflora is now.
Where Euroflora is now.
Euroflora now.
Okay.
Now, after several years, he quit and went to another city. And then some other people came in, Sicilians came. One was Ike Delaney. He started an ice cream parlor on the corner of 7th and Fulton Street. His brother Dominic Delaney, he started a business on 7th and Washington Street for a short time. And then when Jack Rolla came, he had a business on Fulton Street by the tannery.
Yeah, that's what they want to know.
But they were from Sicily now.
They were from Sicily.
Yeah.
But the word spread back.
The word spread, yeah.
Basically. Mm-hmm. And then the one that went back to become a banker, I'm sure he told...
Oh, yes.
He told many people that this was a nice area.
That's right. But it was well known in Italy.
It's surprising, but it was well known.
Yeah, that may be how, when you talked about Sicilians coming, that my grandfather
might have heard that from another Sicilian that, community. Yes. That's right. Mm-hmm. Were there other Italian families in business at that time?
No.
So that was it.
No.
So like the other Pertinos that came, your father's cousins.
Distant relations.
They went to Lansing.
Lansing.
Grand Ledge.
They spread out.
Pontiac. They spread out.
Mm-hmm. And many of them are still in business.
They're still in business, yep.
What was it like for you, being Italian? Did you feel like there was any animosity or things like that coming into an area that was kind of Dutch, and then also not just being Italian, being Catholic? Because I know in the 20s, that's when the Klan starts raising up, and they actually were putting out leaflets in Grand Haven, and they were anti-new immigrants, Jewish and anti-Catholic. So I just wondered.
The country had a whole anti-immigrant.
Yeah. We were very fortunate. My father was very well liked in Grand Haven by all the people, by all of them.
It was well received.
Well respected. Because of the way he did business.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the citizens of Grand Haven came to the store and felt the world of them. We're very fortunate that way. So I felt, I didn't feel any.
No prejudice.
No prejudice whatsoever. I went to Catholic school, of course, until 10th grade. And then I went for two years to high school. I graduated in 1931.
They weren't rich people, my grandparents.
No.
But nor was anyone else, really. I mean, all people were struggling in the early part of the century.
They were all struggling. Peter and Holzman did very well. He did very well. In those days, every other block had a grocery store. In other words, if you want a quart of milk, you have to drive a mile. Every neighborhood had a store.
There was no major grocery store.
No.
The size of Meyer's or anything. That was unheard of, right, Dad?
That's right.
And Grand Haven had a handful of dairy, actually. Milk dairies.
Delivered
the milk.
In fact, my father worked for a dairy when he was a boy. That was one of his summer jobs, wasn't it, Dad?
What's the dairy? $10 a week.
Good wages.
What did you do for them?
Pardon me?
What did you do for them?
I worked in the dairy itself.
Okay.
In the dairy itself.
Did you bottle or did you make ice cream or what did you do?
No, I just took care of the milk.
Just took care of the milk?
No. I worked there 2 summers.
All milk was delivered in those days.
Yeah.
In glass bottles.
But a person like my grandfather could be a large wholesaler at that time because he was furnishing all the small stores.
He furnished all the stores from Thursburg, Spring Lake, Grand Haven. He had them all.
But when 1941, Daddy saw that trend was going away, the bigger businesses, bigger grocery stores, we're going to incorporate all the greengrocer part of it. Right, Dad?
That's right. I saw it was coming, so I changed the whole complexion of the business. I turned into a gourmet shop, as we have today.
You need to change yourself to survive.
You had to change.
Yeah.
Well, all the rest of them are all gone.
We had a small quantity of fruits and vegetables and things in the store for a long time. Until we just sort of phased it out, you know.
Which my dad kept the winter pole of peanuts all the time. I came over to college one day and said, "Dad, those peanuts have been in the winter for years. How about if I take them out and put a nice winter display in there?" And that was kind of a fellow, he lets you find out for yourself. So I took the peanuts out of the window for a nice display in there. Well, the first thing we noticed was the sales of peanuts went down. Then the fellow came in one day from Highland Park and said, "Boy, I had a heck of a time finding you there. I asked for you to buy up some liquor and go right downtown and said, start with a window full of peanuts." And the peanuts were gone. We had a hard time with that. And I hope you've learned a lesson. Number one, if a person sees a product, it's half sold. Number two, he says, that marks our location. Because to go to the peanut full window, That's what had liquor and beer and wine and everything else. That was our trademark. So I didn't say a thing. I took the window spray out, put the peanuts right back in, and they've been in there ever since.
Fresh peanuts all the time. We rotate them.
We rotate them, oh yes, yeah.
But there's always been peanuts in our window ever since.
That's our trademark.
And that was in the, what, like the 1930s, wasn't it, Dad? That you took them out? During college years, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, but I wasn't in college. So I graduated high school in 1931.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was in that time frame that you took them out.
Oh, yeah, in that time frame, yeah. No.
And so we never had to relearn that lesson.
Yeah, I learned it.
And peanuts have been a big part of our business.
A big part of our business.
Now, the process of roasting them, you do that in the building, right?
Pardon me?
The roasting of them? Who learned that skill first? Did your father go somewhere to get that knowledge, or did he just...
He lived in Holland. When he was working in Holland, he worked at Dolly Tilly. But in the evenings, he'd help out Charlie Fabiano, who had an ice cream parlor, and peanuts. He helped him out, and he learned there how to make peanuts when he came to Grand Haven.
That's the peanut store in Holland, right,
yeah.
Dad? To this day? Is that
No. He's on River Street. The peanut store is the son, the grandson,
mm-hmm.
who has a peanut store now.
But it's in the same family.
Same family.
They taught him how to roast peanuts.
And he's obviously handed it on.
Well, he came to Grand Haven, he bought his own machine and started out. And then, of course, all kinds of nuts. We cook them all fresh.
But that machine that roasted the peanuts
is
still in use. Room. And it still works perfectly. I mean, he bought it in 1900 and what, Dad? How old is that machine? About 1915, 1911?
1911, 1912, something like that.
And that machine still works beautifully.
All we ever do is change belts on it, that's all.
How long does it take from the process to go all the peanut to go all the way through and be roasted?
On the old machine, it was 30 minutes. Now, and that's 10 pounds. Now, today we have a new machine, another machine that my son-in-law bought after he took over. That's 20 pounds. That's about 20 minutes, no, 20 minutes.
It's still a slow process.
Still a slow process. Mm-hmm.
But we decided after, he'll get into that when we took over, but we didn't want to ruin the old machine. We wanted to preserve it.
Yeah.
So we bought a second workhorse machine.
Yeah.
So the first one would not age anymore. That was only about, 10 or 15 years ago, Rita?
About that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The machine's still there and it still works in case of emergency.
Okay, now you learned your lesson with the peanuts, but you also were smart enough to figure out that the idea of small neighborhood store was
on its way out.
Okay. How did customers first perceive the change? Were they welcome to it?
Well, I was going to make it known. We used to advertise extensively one time by mail. We used to run ads in the Seton Chronicle, the Tribune, and the Holland Sentinel. Let them know what we changed and what we had. I mentioned the products that we carried. So it took a long time, but finally people began to find out. So they want something unusual. Go for Tino's, he's got everything.
But it took time. Gourmet was not the name of the game then.
No. It took a long time to change the eating habits to people's eating habits
to try new things. Would you say that?
That's right. Of course, all the time for peanuts. All the time for peanuts. Oh, yeah.
But I think we learned how to use a lot of interesting products, and to this day, particularly my sister, who's an excellent cook, knows how to teach people how to use interesting products. So you keep building your trade, in a sense. You don't just come to us to buy it. We show you how to use it. And that started with Daddy trying to encourage gourmet things, because that was new.
We got up on spice. We had a mail once. I wish we had it here to show it to you.
We do, actually.
We sent a lot of mail out. We did a lot of advertising those days. We let them know what kind of store we had.
That's nice.
That was an advertising piece. It's a spice list.
Three of the season. You open it up, it's all the spices and how to use them. That's just one of our mailing pieces.
Yep.
So it took us quite a while to change, you know.
People are much more experimental in foods now than they used to be. So this encouraged them to try different spices.
Mm-hmm.
But it was slow going to get the gourmet established, wasn't it, Dad?
Slow going.
But during the war, you also had a second job.
Oh, yeah.
Because everybody had to work for the war after.
Yeah. I tried it in the Navy, but I couldn't do this and I had heart murmur. So I went to work for the Army Engineers. And I passed their exams. I spent 5 years with the Army Engineers. My job was to inspect war material, the western part of Michigan and the northern half of Indiana. That was my territory. 5 years, that's all I did, travel back and forth. My wife ran the business.
He was gone from Monday morning until, what, Saturday night's dead?
Yeah. Sometimes I wouldn't come back for 2 or 3 weeks.
He was gone constantly. Yeah. So after they married at 41, the war started, of course, late 41, and he went straight into the Corps of Engineers, and my mother ran the business.
She ran the business, you know.
With my grandfather's help.
My father helped out naturally. Yeah.
And your Aunt Mary, my sister...
Yeah.
His sister Mary was still working.
Yes, she helped out too. Huh?
So at the end of the war, then he came home to run the business entirely.
At the end of the war, there was still a lot of neighborhood business then. But gradually, it started changing off. Say there isn't one left. Not one left. It's a shame.
Yeah.
You can't compete.
Yeah. I remember growing up, there were at least two grocery stores in walking distance of my house.
Sure.
And it's not that way anymore. And some of that is when the highways started coming in.
Yeah.
You get highways, people got around easier.
Yeah.
So it changed that. But
it was slow change, but it was a definite change.
It took into the 50s and for
even
people
into
to
the
do
60s
that,
before they finally were all gone.
Right.
Mr. Erickson was one of the last, I think, on Franklin Street.
There is one store downtown left now, except the what's the clothing store that my mother goes to?
Baz's?
No, downtown.
How many businesses are of left of that longevity?
There's only one left, and that's Decades, because that's changed hands. It used to be Addison Balls. One time, then Steffi's. There's the only one left, but not with the original order.
Well, Baz's was there before that, but a new change.
No.
The big store.
It was a big store. And the owner, during the pressure, hung himself.
Of the big store?
On the big store. Then Baz took over.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there were two brothers. One, I think, the Vanderbosch brothers, and one of them did hang himself in the building.
Yeah.
So while I worked there, that was always interesting to know that the spirit was still there, people said.
And a grocery store downtown, what was the name of Ball? Garrett Ball had a grocery store downtown. Right across from Stuckey's. During Depression days, and he hung himself to Garrett Ball, well-known grocer. That's how things were during Depression days.
How did that affect your father's business? How did he make it through the Depression?
He kept on going. Yeah.
But he had the habit of, if anything were like the drops, the fruits that were drops, correct me if I'm wrong, Dad, but he would put those outside in bags, and people could come and take those, no questions asked.
No.
So nobody went hungry because he had any food that he could have spare. He just put it outside. Is that how he did it, Daddy?
Yeah. Some of the old timers today, there were kids those days, but when the boxcar came, of bananas came, all the kids were congregated because all the bananas that were loose, that was given to the kids.
And that was a treat.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine today.
In those days, kids didn't have much. They probably had an orange during Christmas time. In those days, and that's probably all they had.
Yeah, that's the hard part to imagine.
So when Carlo stuff came in, the word got around. A truckload of Carlo watermelons or whatever it was, bananas especially. All those ones that fell off, the kids got. As a matter of fact, there was quite an article in the Tribune about that one time, brought that out. The kids would congregate and wait for the and it was unloaded, and Russians get all the looses.
Because that was a major treat.
Yeah, that was a treat.
But he made it through the Depression, but he shared a great deal.
Yeah.
People would come to him, and if they didn't have anything, and he would just say, pay me someday. Right, Dad?
My mother died.
You get it.
He spoke to my mother to various people, homes, and give them food. Give them food. I can name some point, but it'd be too embarrassing to learn.
But they would deliver it. Just whoever needed it.
Yeah.
And my grandfather would just tell them. They would sometimes offer him their property because they were very proud.
Yeah.
But my grandfather never accepted anything. He just said, if someday you can afford it, you could pay me back. Is that right, Dad?
Well, you were mentioning it. My father had a great reputation in your hand with all these holidays.
Well, that would definitely
all
help.
His friends were like Bill Hatton, the Sherwoods, like Neil Ball, Lauder. They all came to the store and thought the world of them. He had them all. Yeah. Very fortunate.
Yeah.
Some people aren't that fortunate.
No, but I mean, that's good business, I think, that he was doing that, because when people get on their feet, then
they remember,
who helped them out.
Yeah, but he didn't, he was not the kind to try and remind them,
right.
You know what I mean? He always wanted to keep their pride intact.
Yeah.
He knew how hard things were.
That's right.
But he is the last, ours is the last business, family owned, original owners, still
right.
Down there. That's the last one now.
Ted Poole has a kind of story. I thought I got about 20 of these things put away. They used to accuse me of having partnership with the Tribune, because every once in a while he'd write a big article like this. I could go get them for you if you want, but about 20 of them just like this. And appeared every once in a while. They want to know if I had an interest in the Tribune.
Yeah.
But see, Reichardt started, and Mr. Reichardt was a great friend of my grandfather and of my father.
That's one of the articles Ted wrote, he brings that out. Not my car, my dad were the last ones left. But he was left.
He was a great man too, Mr. Reichardt,
yes, he was.
Senior.
Yes, he was.
Very
successful.
In the Depression, was it when there was, or no, after, during the war, there was no boxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing was wasted.
No.
So if you needed a box, he would share. He helped my mother, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
You know, make sure that if he had anything coming in, he'd bring the boxes to our store so we could use them.
Yep.
It was a very helpful kind of situation. But after his grandson sold, that was the last, one of the last family businesses left. The original owner.
Okay.
When my father got married, they decided to come back to Grand Haven, and I took over the business, and I let them have the business 19 years ago.
But there was, you should tell, there's five of us, and you had five children.
Yeah. I had five children, yeah. I had my son Paul, who's an attorney in Portland, Oregon. My son John, who's a Merrill Lynch, who lives in Spring Lake. And I have my daughter, Mary Teresa, who's president of a computer company. I have Rita, and I have Margaret. So 19 years ago, I think it was 19 years ago, they took over the store, and they've done a wonderful job to this day.
But the longevity comes from helping each other. My father and mother, we came back and stayed, learned the first year from 76 to 77 after my husband got out of the military, how to run a business.
Mm-hmm.
But then after we took over and signed the papers, my mom and dad stayed with us for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that training ground is what, and same with his father, allowed you a smooth and peaceful transition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's, many people don't know we own it, actually. I mean, I've just found out in the last few years. Because we never made an issue of that. We just smoothly went into the next generation.
Retain the name.
Retain the name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that would be, if you change that, that would be just like,
that'd be the end.
That'd be like the peanuts in the window.
Exactly. You don't knock success.
That's right.
And it's been a very, very good life for us as well.
Yeah.
My husband came from the same kind of a background as my father, an engineering background, got a master's degree from Notre Dame, and that's where I met him, was at Notre Dame. My brother was teaching there, and my husband was teaching there. And so after that, his life was similar to my father's in the sense that he knew that he's had a degree in nuclear power, and they move you every 2 years too. Yeah. And the same kind of thinking went into our life. We didn't want that for our children, and so we decided to take over the business and have proceeded to have 4 children of our own, and they all work there now. But we don't know where the future is yet.
Right, that's that was my question. Uh-huh. Do you sense an heir to your throne?
Well, you know, we don't know. Our oldest son, is an aerospace engineer in California, and our next son is going to be a maritime mechanical engineer. He's a senior in college, and
MIT.
Then we have two younger. Yeah, he's at MIT, and then we have two younger children. Mike, and they're both very good in the store. My daughter seems to be the most business-minded. So who knows? Who knows? My father probably figured always would be the boys in our family, and it turned out to be the girl.
Yeah.
So who knows? We don't know what the future is going to hold.
Well,
they all like the business.
Your sons have the engineering degrees at least. Because it sounds like you need an engineering degree to do the peanuts.
We always say that you do it from nuke power to peanut power. But that brings you up to modern day,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of the family. But
this is Tom Spoon. We are continuing our interview with Paul Fortino, and today is the 29th day of July, 1997. Okay, Paul, why don't you tell us about what you told me about before, that you had the store was actually in two buildings, different buildings.
Our first store was at 126 Washington Street. And we lived upstairs, our family was upstairs. In 1930, they had a little fire. Not much, but enough to damage the store. In the meantime, where our building is now, there was a theater there called the Temple. Later on, they changed it to Rivoli. That burned down completely. So my dad bought the property and cleaned up all that mess. It was a theater and a dish shop. He cleaned it all up and had this building built. That was in 1923.
Okay. And you've been in that building ever since?
Yes. Here.
Okay. And
now, what did I say about 1926?
In 126 Washington.
126 Washington.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, that was really nice upstairs. All brand new. We were very pleased with it. Time my dad downstairs started up a new business. I put a can of fruits and vegetables and some groceries. I did all right. She did pretty good.
Okay, so you, when you lived above the building when you were a kid, did you help out at all?
Oh, yes. We all worked. All the kids worked. We all had our jobs. And my father was a very good dad. Yeah. In the meantime, my father couldn't read and write. So as a youngster, I would take care of the books. And when sales tax time came around, and the year when you make up income tax, the bank would do it for us. Those days, that's the kind of service they gave.
Okay, you wrote all the checks, so.
Nothing I've often I talk about. The policemen on the beach, they were very helpful, very kind. I know when we had the food outside, display outside, at night time they help us put it in. Yes, they helped put it in. Not only that, when we had beer and wine, the policemen on the beach would come and help us fill with coolers. And that's how things have changed downtown.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very friendly atmosphere downtown. All the neighbors stood stores. We'd go back and forth and visit each other. Next door to us was a cigar store where a man rolled his old cigars. And I was in there myself a lot of times. I listened to all those old fellows talk about politics and so forth, and that's where I got interested in public service. Listen to those old fellows.
Yeah.
Of course, they solved all the problems of the day. And it's very interesting to each other, yes.
I say everybody knew everybody.
Okay. Right. Everybody, in those days, everybody knew each other up and down the street. They'd go back and forth, visit. It was entirely different than it is today, of course. Coppish wasn't so keen then. But later on, when Coppish came, then things changed a little bit. Yes, a lot of stories had hurt. But unfortunately, we still kept going and doing all right.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what did your, how did your father view his employees? What did he do with them?
Okay. But,
yeah.
Well, my dad, the employee, he treated them like a part of the family. I'll give you an illustration. We hired Bernadette Hooks. We hired her, and when the first day, she could go out to lunch. I said, no, you're not going to lunch. You go upstairs and eat with my family. From now on, instead, she worked for us for 40 years before she retired. Her husband, Neil Hooks, also worked for us. Afterwards, for the A&P, he retired as a meat cutter. He came to us, and he worked for us too for years. And they're very, very, just like one big family. That's what it's always been, all the time. One big family.
Now, you had one of the first liquor licenses, or the first in Grand Haven after Prohibition.
We had the first one in Grand Haven, the first liquor license. Our hours in the liquor was 7 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. And that's the hours that we stuck to. They're long hours, but interesting. Our business increased, and people were happy about the Prohibition being repealed. Those were great days.
Yeah.
Wonderful days.
And it was activity downtown.
A lot of activity. A lot of activity.
It was warranted to be open, too.
Right, the city, or the state told you that you were going to be open 7
yes.
to 11, right?
Right.
It was heavily encouraged for you to have a license.
From 7 in the morning to 11 at night. Long hour, but the hour went fast because we were so busy. We saved service until 1955, and all five children were born and raised upstairs. And 1955, we bought this house here on 535 Clinton Street. We've been here ever since.
And my grandfather moved in with us.
And my grandfather moved in with us.
And that your dad. Yeah.
So, he passed away when he was 79 years old. My mother passed away when she was 63 years old.
She died very young. She died early. She died in 41.
So downtown, since when you were down there to today, has changed somewhat, I would think, right?
Quite a bit. Okay. Are you recording?
Yep.
In my lifetime, I noticed a dramatic change in downtown. I'll give some examples. In my day, there were two coal dealers downtown on the river. One was Nat Roberts, the other was Nelson Fisher. They were both gone. There were two hotels. They're gone. There's two pool rooms and a bowling alley. That's gone. There's five ice cream parlors. They're gone. There's five grocery stores. They're gone. There's two electrical stores. They're gone. There's two cigar stores. Well, each one rolled their own cigars. I used to watch roll cigars. It's very interesting how they roll their own cigars. It's the cigars they roll sold for 5 cents a piece. 5 cents. Can you imagine that?
No.
Did they pay? There's two drug stores. They're both gone. There's two hardware stores. They're both gone. There's two dime stores. They're both gone. There's three meat markets. They're both gone. There's three furniture stores downtown. The only one left now is Parentes on 3rd Street.
Yeah. Were they always located there, though? Or were they on the main street at one
no.
time?
What the go on Main Street.
Okay. But was Piranha's originally on the main street and moved, I guess is what I'm asking.
I don't think so.
Okay.
On 3rd Street now.
Yeah.
And there's three men's clothing stores downtown. One on the left now is Bonds on 3rd Street. No, another thing that's very interesting. At my day, there were 6 medical offices building downtown. 6 medical offices downtown. 6 of them. And there was three dental offices. Now there's only one. There were 2 chiropractors downtown. They're both gone. The Salvation Army was downtown. That's gone. There was 2 food stores downtown. They're gone. So there's been a dramatic change downtown
yeah.
in my lifetime.
Well, it seems, sounds like the whole, that downtown was the absolute lifeblood of a community.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
needed to come down there for every one of your needs
yeah.
was down there. They weren't met anywhere
Everything.
Else.
Everything's downtown. You want a tape or a bulb or two electrical stores competing with each other. Believe it or not.
And if you wanted to go to a doctor or a bank or you wanted to go anywhere, you came downtown for it. You didn't have other options. And that
downtown, on Saturday nights, was so thick with people you could hardly walk on the sidewalk. Because that's where everything was.
And how many theaters, were there theaters
there
down there?
There were two theaters downtown. Now there's only one part-time.
Yeah.
You want to put that down?
Yeah, sorry.
So, as you can see, there's been a tremendous change in my lifetime. But downtown right now is healthy.
It's healthy. It's reflective of the times.
Yeah.
What's not, things that are not needed to have moved out to other parts of the community, basically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, are a lot of the buildings still the buildings that were there when these other people were there? Or have we lost a lot of buildings down there?
There's been a lot of remodeling. A lot of remodeling and some addition. Some addition, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As if you look, but mostly remodeling. Another thing I'd like to mention, too, how things are different in shopping. Let's talk about Ekins Grocery Store. This is very interesting. In the store, he had a counter. On the counter, he had, behind the counter, he had stools. The woman would come into the shop, she'd sit on a stool, and she'd tell the clerk what she wanted. And the clerk would put it on the counter. What they'll do, the clerk would mark it down on the charge and paid once a month and deliver it to her home. And that time, it was delivered all over town, including Highland Park in the summertime. Delivered. Can you imagine that service?
You were never expected to pick up your own groceries, a woman.
No,
you've never been expected to carry that weight.
Can you imagine today you'd have a clerk sit on a stool and have a clerk put something on front of you? Well, that's the way it was.
Yeah.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, yeah, but this thing has changed dramatically.
But it's one of the things that we have kept alive to a certain degree, not quite as much, that people still love, is that they feel they get some personal service.
Mm-hmm.
That we will walk around with them in the store, and carry it out and so forth. There's still that some personal feeling. But I know that your father always thought that pop or things in glass bottles would never sell, because there's no way that people would lift that weight. That would be that was a death knell. That would never work, right, Dad?
The 60 ounces.
I remember the Coca-Cola came out with 8 packs of 12-ounce bottles. I said to him, that won't work. It's too heavy for the average woman. I was wrong. I was up to Casseller. These women, when they want to, can lift anything they want, when they want to. That's one thing we learned.
Yeah.
But they just thought they would not want that kind of
too much
work,
weight.
Too much weight.
Yeah.
So the whole thing's changed.
Yeah.
Changed it dramatically.
I knew about the accounts. Did you guys do any of that early on? Did you guys have just let people buy stuff on credit?
Well, no, not in the retail store, no, but when my dad had the wholesale house, it was all on credit.
Yeah.
It settled up at the end of every week. My dad's a wholesale business, everything came in by carload. The watermelons, the bananas, you name it. Interestingly about bananas, but carload bananas come in, hundreds of kids with gangrene at the railroad station, and I'll tell you why. As the outloads of bananas, some would drop off. And all the bananas dropped off, belonged to the kids. When they got to, I love that car. You should see the kids swarm in the box car and pick up those bananas. In those days, you know, a fruit wasn't as plentiful as is today with kids. An orange is something that you saw at Christmas time. That's how things have changed in my lifetime.
But you had no charge retail accounts, did you, Dad?
No.
And we still don't to this day.
I know.
We don't do charge. We're not computerized or we haven't modernized in that sense at all. And in fact, it's one of the things people do not want us to do at all is modernize. We have that constantly, don't we, Dad?
Yep.
They don't like change because there's nothing left that reminds them of their youth.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't computerize. We use a cash register and adding machines from the 30s.
Meantime, while I'm building my business, I became very active in local politics. Local people. For example, I belong to the Harbor Commission. I belong to the City Finance Committee. I'm on the Hospital Board. of the first incorporators of the Tri-City Industrial Committee. I was president of the Chamber of Commerce.
When you get all these things.
I was on the planning commission for the new high school, which at that time was located on Cutler Street, not the present one now, the one that built 1945-46. I was also on the committee in 1952 for the addition to the high school. 1957, I was on the committee for neighborhood schools, of which Marion White is one of them. As you can see, I kept myself pretty busy.
Yes.
I was the first trustee of the present local Knights of Columbus. I was on the St. Patrick's Church Committee as well. Well, the outstanding thing in my lifetime I like to think about. The first one I'd like to the board member of the Security First Bank and Trust Company, which is now Old Kent. Next thing that happened, I received a citation for the U.S. engineers for my work during World War II. I shook up the hang of the back room.
That's something to be proud of.
I'm very proud of that. When I retired from the business, I got a citation from the state of Michigan, which I'm very proud of, commending me for my local activities. I'm very proud of those citations. The Grand Haven, Alex Eagles, and Knights of Columbus, and a longtime member of the Historical Society. That's very important.
Yes, it is.
Now, where to go from here now? I went to Catholic school to the 10th grade. I was in St. Patrick's in 10th grade, 2 years of high school. After I graduated from there, they discontinued those last 2 years. So I spent 2 years in public high school. I graduated in 1931. I didn't go to college right away during Depression days, so I stayed out of school and worked at the dairy.
You did that, though.
Yeah.
I think good.
So, finally, I graduated Notre Dame in 1938 with honors in chemical engineering.
That same St. Patrick's School we attended as well. All of us children all attended it, and they didn't close it until probably mid-60s to late 60s.
I think it was. I just missed going.
So we were all able to finish at St. Patrick's.
And that was located where the highway is today.
That's on the highway of today.
Yeah.
Actually, in the parking lot of the St. Patrick's Presence Church.
On Fulton Street.
Yeah.
A lot of the kids then transferred over to St. Mary's in Spring Lake, and that's where his grandchildren, my children, all went to St. Mary's in Spring Lake.
We know in those days, after the war, they became very, very conscious of meals. They wanted something different. During the war, there was a lot of scarcity. But now after the war, they came back and they wanted something different. And they would ask us for something different. So, as time went on, they kept on adding more and more and more. The immigrants came in. They started asking for questions for different things. So we put them in. Everything they asked for, we put them in. For example, what was some of the stuff we put in?
Well, you had a large Latvian population, didn't you?
Uh-huh.
They were just displaced persons, you know, during the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted tons of things. And they had very specific foods because they had just come over. They were sponsored to this area. The Latvians.
A lot of fish products.
A lot of fish products.
Well, and after World War II, you guys had told me, too, that explain a little more of why the meal was important, the table, actually, and the meal.
Hospitality was very important.
Go ahead.
Hmm? Well, during the war, there was scarcity. They had a couple lot of stuff they couldn't get. But after the war, stuff came back, and they could afford it. So there was a demand for that, for something different. And as I said before, when the immigrants came in, they wanted stuff they had in the old country. So we put that in nationally. That goes for all nationalities. All immigrants poured in, we received to them. Whatever they wanted, we got it for them.
And soldiers during the war were exposed to European foods too, I think.
And they wanted the same thing. So we put them in. And that's how we haven't been started this, up to the position we are in now.
But it became very important to serve a nice table.
Oh, yeah.
Did it not?
Yes, it was. At that time, yes.
Yeah. In what regard? It just, it showed hospitality.
Orange.
To the better quality food you could put out.
Well, that's still true today, honey.
That's still true today.
Yeah.
But that became very important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About what culturally that you showed hospitality by having a large meal, a good quality, and so forth. And that gave us a niche completely.
I'll give you one example. For example, when you say spices, people thought of salt and pepper. At one time, we carried 45 different spices. People asked for everything different. So we carried 45 different spices in those days. That's just one item.
But they didn't start out selling 45 immediately.
Oh, right.
My mom and dad had to learn and show them how to use these different spices.
Right. There were itch in the table.
Yeah.
Very itch.
It was a growing process.
Yeah. So we kept up with it. Kept us busy. Kept us real busy. Keeping up with the demand.
And as each group of immigrants came in, as Daddy said, there was a large group of Latvians, displaced persons, that came in. And it was in the 50s, wasn't it?
Everybody got together on the Latvians.
Yeah.
And they got furniture for them and clothing.
Do you know all about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure, found a place to live.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. Yeah, see, they were displaced by the Russians, weren't they, Dad?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them lost their homes and had to flee quickly.
Yeah.
And they were sponsored into this country, and a lot of them came to live here. I grew up with a lot of them, went to school with the kids. But they would be the children of the parents that came during the 50s. And they became model citizens, of course. They were wonderful human beings. But they had left, basically, I think, the way I understand, they just left. They had nothing to start out with.
Nothing left.
They came with nothing. So the churches and the businesses.
The town got together and provided them with furniture and food and a place to live.
And a start.
And a start in life.
It was a time of great change after the war. Great change took place in every aspect. Unless something else we talk about? Well, I'll end up with this. I've had 5 children. I've been very fortunate. I've had a wonderful wife. I had a wonderful life. What more could a man ask for than that?
Not much. And now you even have some wonderful grandchildren probably too, right?
I have wonderful grandchildren. 10 of them.
We're very proud of them.
I'm very proud of each one of them. That's what makes life so wonderful.
And they have had a good full life, my parents, so they've been able to see each one of those grandchildren almost grown. I mean, most of them are almost grown, the youngest being 14 years old already.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have for a few more years, they'll see them all the way through.
Won't be many years.
This town has been very good to Daddy, to my grandfather, and to my family. It just
I have been wonderful to us.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful to us. I wouldn't think of anything else besides Grandhaven.
When Grandpa said it was God's country, he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. When he came to Grandhaven, he says, "This is God's country."
That's right.
And it has been for all of us. It's still a mecca for all of us. Three of us stayed, and the two that are gone come home as often as possible.
That's right.